Now, we're fortunate today to have a couple of our elected officials with us today who can unfortunately only be with us for a short while. But we've asked them to reflect upon what they've heard so far and what it might mean for the work that they do. So first, I want to introduce you Martin Ludlow, newly elected city council member for the 10th District. Someone who's been a long time an advocate for justice and interracial solidarity. Martin.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Robin, for the introduction, and it's really been wonderful working with you. And one of the things that I've often reflected on is, I think, as mentioned in the introductory piece, that I'd served as an advisor to the LA Human Relations Commission. And one of the things that I'm really hoping that we can do in the city of LA is come into some close proximity to the great work that the LA County Human Relations Commission is doing under Robin Toma. It is also, I should acknowledge, Applied Research Center. Thank you for this day, the co-sponsors who have helped bring this meeting together and the meetings that are happening around the country. And then also to First AME Church for hosting today. Chip Murray and Reverend Jackson have really been a beacon of hope in South Los Angeles and throughout the city. And so I really appreciate their willingness to step up and host today's discussion. Yes. I have written in just a few minutes about four pages of notes. And what's very challenging is to actually try to put my thoughts at this moment into some kind of coherent, organized response, because it's both emotionally overwhelming to hear the testimony of the individuals that I just heard. But as many of you know here, better than I do in many ways, it's an amazingly daunting reality that we're all facing right now in this country. One thing that really struck me is the context of today and what my day has been like today, where I just left. I wasn't able to stay for the march, but I was able to share a few moments and reflections as another labor union today kicked off in Los Angeles, the Poor People's Campaign, by SEIU and many of the other labor unions that are joining together. The 40th year anniversary of the March on Washington, to think where we are as a nation right now and to look at the realities of where we have come, where we have arrived, and where the priorities of this nation has shifted to. I was reading a part of King's book, the autobiography, where he talked about how fast this nation was heading to hell for its inability to recognize the poor and the oppressed. And there was an amazing context to where we are right now. Listening to these testimonies are just amazing. I wanted to mention Victor. I actually had the privilege of seeing Victor and some of the Youth Justice LA members doing a skit with Professor Bilal I'm forgetting the country, I think it was Brazil. He'd come to the United States to host his, what I believe is called a theater legislation, where in Brazil he championed the effort of having theater as a way of impacting public policy and showing public policy leaders how the issues and the policies that are in place are impacting the public. And Victor and the group did a phenomenal skit that they had, I guess, rehearsed for less than a couple of hours on the gang database. And it was just chilling to see the way in which the Los Angeles Police Department and the city of Los Angeles continues to stand behind a policy that, in my opinion, puts the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, and due process on its head. And as I mentioned then and want to reiterate to Victor, one of the things that I would like to work on now in my 59th day on the L.A. City Council is some significant review and challenge as a public policy to that policy, which continues to maintain a gang database. With that, in just one small example, I don't know if some of you read, I was actually excited that the LA Times wrote something kind of exciting for me. We organized a program called A Summer of Success in Baldwin Hills this summer, and it was an effort to take an area that has been called the jungle, where crime and homicide rates have been just disproportionately high in terms of overall crime in Los Angeles. In the period of time that we organized this, during the time that school was out, I will just leave you with this simple thing. It was a 5-point strategy in terms of trying to reduce violence in that part of LA. And we hired young people from Baldwin Village. They ran the program. We had after evening programs all night long. A lot of things happened. The point of the matter, 27% reduction in crime in that area. Not a single gang injunction had anything to do with it. And that, to me, is a statement about how we can start showing examples proactively of alternatives to the public policy that has become very regressive and restrictive in this country. Finally, because I know I'm really out of time, I just, again, want to really say to those individuals that testified today, this is kind of, I'm going to try to wrap up some closing thoughts here. There's about 5 different themes rolling around in my head. There was a book that I remember getting years and years ago called Black Voices. Black Voices is a very ugly depiction of the incredible brutality associated with the lynchings of African Americans during the 50s and 60s. And it still is a book that I keep in my house, and it's on my coffee table. And when you come into my house, you see Black Voices, and you see the images of black children hanging from their necks, castrated. And for my children who have come to know Black Voices, it's been a very chilling reminder of the history of this nation and how the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and what we originally, in my opinion, stood for has been totally turned up on its head. Right now, you are sitting in the Crenshaw community, which has long been viewed as the heart of the African-American community. But for many of you that have studied this area know that the area you're standing in is one of the longest-standing Japanese-American communities anywhere in the country. And what, in fact, has been amazing is when I walked door-to-door right here in the Crenshaw Corridor, I met people that had moved here at the turn of the century, the 20th century. They're in their late 90s and obviously early hundreds, but they were able to get their homes back after being interned following the war. And it is something that comes very close to home in terms of what is happening here in L.A. Illiteracy and poverty, to me, in my closing thought, pose a greater threat to democracy than this ridiculous concept of this war on terrorism. Illiteracy and poverty, if we were to begin to list the thousands of lives that have been lost due to just the vicious cycle of poverty. Right now, we're 3 weeks away from potentially the passage of Proposition 54, which could outlaw and ban the ability of government to track health statistics based on race at a time when white women suffer and are more susceptible to breast cancer than anyone else in this country, at a time when black women are more susceptible to dying from breast cancer. Being able to track heart disease and kidney failure, tuberculosis by race, these are the ways in which race can be used as a proactive and a solid public policy and a progressive public policy. What we have in fact been able to witness in just a short period of time and listening to these testimonies of the way in which Ashcroft and George Bush have turned the Constitution and the Bill of Rights upside down is just chilling. It's just chilling. What you have done for me today, and again, I haven't been on the council for yet 2 months, is to really raise my awareness today of a significant opportunity for public policy leaders in L.A. as the second largest city in the country to make a stand, to begin to go on record that we oppose the administration and the way in which they're treating Americans and immigrants in this country. And that's something that we can, in fact, do. I believe an open blank check for this war in the Middle East is an abomination. We need to begin to demand accountability. we need to begin demanding accountability for the billions and billions of dollars that are going away for nothing more at this point than not only international terrorism, but domestic terrorism. And you're going to hear from Marielena de Rosso shortly. But the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, which kicks off in Los Angeles in just a couple of weeks, to me is a phenomenal opportunity to continue the proactive position that you all are doing by merely holding these forums throughout the country. I hope we can find a partnership in the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride and bring many of you out to take a stand that this country was created by immigrants, is built by immigrants, continues to be run by immigrants, and we are the ones who, in fact, make this country work. We need to stand up and demand justice, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have some new blood in City Council. I think that we're in a period where I think we might be seeing a new wave of progressive officials and activists that really can build a mass to make things happen here. So I'm very hopeful for that. And I did want to actually at this point introduce to you Reverend Arthur Takemoto. And before I do that, I just wanted to just say a little bit about him. You know, when 9/11 happened, I think that particularly for Japanese Americans, when they heard the comparisons to Pearl Harbor, which were being made on the television at that day, that morning, I know that Japanese Americans like myself shuddered that moment, because we knew through our family's experience what happened when this country felt threatened, how quickly that insecurity could turn into mass discrimination. And I actually, at that moment, realized what we were facing, because I saw on television what was being seen, whose face was being portrayed as the enemy. And even though there was scanned information at that time, the images were enough. That alongside the terror of what we were seeing. We had a conference call because we couldn't go into the office given the fact there were planes headed towards potentially towards Los Angeles that were unaccounted for at that moment. I did not send my staff into their offices in downtown LA. Instead, we hooked up on the phone and we got together and we immediately put into place a plan to respond to it. Immediately, I went to the Emergency Operations Center and I talked to supervisors Burke and Kanabi, who were there, and I told them, at this moment, while you're recognizing the horror of what's happening, the loss that we're seeing in New York and in the D.C. and in Pennsylvania, please, please tell people, do not look towards your neighbor and attempt to blame them for what has happened. Do not blame people based on their national origin, their religion, their appearance for what is happening. And we need to hear from you, because when we don't hear from you, things will happen. And I am proud to say that they did make mention of that, and those voices were heard. And we didn't see internment, although, quite frankly, there were voices in Congress that raised the issue of internment for Arab Americans. And let's be frank, the discrimination, the negative stereotyping about Arab Americans and Muslim Americans long pre-existed 9/11. So it's really important at those moments that when we're focused on the immediate scare, on the immediate threat, that we don't forget the larger scope of history and what's already happened and what we will be foolish to allow to happen again. So with that, I want to introduce to you Reverend Takemoto, who was in his early 20s in Los Angeles when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And he'll talk a little bit about that period and how 9/11 brought him back. Reverend Takemoto.
I'm an old man, so it takes a little time to get adjusted. My name is Arthur Takemoto, and Arthur is an alias. I adapted that name by myself when I was in the third grade because they couldn't pronounce my first name. I felt, well, I had two disadvantages. One, I had a physical handicap from when I was 3 years old, so now I've lived with it for 78 years. So having a physical handicap at the same time, having a Japanese name which was mispronounced, not only by the students, by the teachers, and it disgusted me so much that I adopted the name Arthur, but it's not my real name. My real name is Akeo. Very simple, four letters, A-K-E-O. And I couldn't imagine why they couldn't pronounce Akeo. It came out everything else but that. And so I was so disappointed, I changed my name to Arthur. And to this day, I use the name Arthur. But I prefer to use my first name because of my first name. I learned recently from my father that it meant a very, very meaningful name. Akeo means a very brilliant, bright boy. Ha! But I heard the speakers this moment, the kind of agony and the frustrations that they've gone through, and I can certainly sympathize and feel for them in the same sense that we as Japanese Americans face the same situation, and especially when World War II broke out. I grew up in East Los Angeles. I was one of the Boyle Hiders. And I'm was very, very proud to say that I went to school, Roosevelt High School, because it was one of the most cosmopolitan high schools in the Los Angeles City District. I served as a student body president in 1940 and then moved on to Metropolitan School of Business, which was which is now called Los Angeles Technical College, where I spent 2 years, and I became the vice president and the student body president of Metropolitan School of Business. Then the war broke out. The war broke out, which made it very, very difficult for us. And as you know, all of us, when the war broke out, I was sitting in a theater with my friends on 7th and Broadway, which was the Lowell's Theater, and watching a movie when the announcement of the Fox movie told that war was declared, Pearl Harbor was bombed. We sneaked out of the theater and went to what is presently known as Little Tokyo, and Little Tokyo was just blank, dark. All the stores were closed. My friend had a candy store there, so we sneaked into the candy store. And as we were in the candy store, flashlights were being flashed into the building, and we hid under the counter until they disappeared. All the stores closed because most of the owners were incarcerated. The Buddhist temple which I belonged had 9 priests, and they were all taken. They were incarcerated also, and their families were stranded. And people wondered, why should they pick up all these people without any process, without any legal assistance? And in reviewing all of this, much of this happened. The Japanese, because they were Japanese and had stores and who were importers or exporters of Japanese goods, were targeted. They were probably members of what is known as the Japanese Business Association, which immediately says whether these people are dangerous. And they incarcerated all the Buddhist priests. Not all of them, but majority of the Buddhist priests. And why were they incarcerated? The reason for this, oh, already 2 minutes, oh my goodness. All right. The reason why the Buddhist priests were incarcerated is because, most of them, because of a livelihood, they taught in a Japanese language school. And teaching in a Japanese language school, they were suspect. The other second was that they made perhaps a great mistake in determining that since our temples were from Japan, the founding was in Japan, that it may have been connected with Shintoism. So they didn't, the people, the authorities did not know the difference between Shintoism and Buddhism. These were the situations. We were really, in other words, pressured for in every direction. In fact, Japanese Americans had to wear badges to say we are Americans of Japanese descent. Then the Koreans and the Chinese became scared because they thought they would also be branded, so they began to have, we are Chinese Americans. And then the Korean says, we are Korean Americans. And this is the kind of what we might recall today as racial profiling. So such was the situation that happened for the Japanese people. And then to have all 110,000 Japanese incarcerated in areas which one wouldn't think of living had happened. But when such a thing occurred, then you know, after realizing that that the United States government made a mistake and they apologized, and the same situation seems to have occurred since September 11th. We need to really redefine, really reevaluate our society. And the Buddhists have said, this is the world of decadence. And truly, unless we reevaluate our way of life, we be able to put our hands together in reverence, which means we respect one another as human beings, then this world will collapse. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Akeo Takemoto. It certainly is a similar experience that many people have reported after 9/11. Many Arab Americans have said their children have said, we want to change our names. We feel like we cannot even be identified with their own heritage. And this need to have to prove your patriotism. You know, you have to fly the flag in order to be beyond suspicion if you are Muslim or Middle Eastern appearing. And it's startling that in not so long ago there was a poll that showed that about 30% of persons polled in the United States did not know about the internment of the 110,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. There's actually a bill in Congress that would help to provide additional money for that education. I hope people will support it. I hope it gets passed. At this time, we have another special treat for you that has been planned to sort of take a break from the testimony, and that is Denise Uehara, who is a performance artist. She recently interviewed members of the community about their experience after 9/11 and created a performance piece called Big Head. And I've seen it, parts of it, and she's a wonderful performer. It's inspired by an interview with Adina Lekovic, who is the editor of the Muslim American news magazine, The Minaret. And I believe Denise, yes, there she is, she's ready. Go ahead, Denise.
I was the editor of the UCLA paper, the Daily Bruin. And that put me in a unique position, especially as a young Muslim woman in this nation. I started at the Bruin in my freshman year, but I wasn't African Muslim until my sophomore year, so people saw me go through, I don't know if you would call it a transformation, but an evolution. And people saw me trying to figure out what I was doing with my life and my own identity. So as I worked my way through the staff, it was never really an issue. It wasn't until I was a candidate for editor-in-chief, and the staff held a hearing. That's when the staff endorses a candidate, and I'll never forget. A Japanese-American man said to me directly, "So, what effect is you being Muslim going to have on the job that you do here?" And I was really offended. But I said, besides the fact that I'm going to be trained 5 times a day, and that might take a few minutes here and there, and beyond the fact that I'm a moral person and I believe in the ethics, which might benefit this paper, beyond that, I don't think this has anything to do with anybody else. But I was upset that I let it upset me. I think that's the first time I realized what the road ahead is going to be like, because you get sort of insulated. Working at a newspaper and dealing with the outside community. I think that people were surprised when they would come into our office and see me as the one in charge of over 100 staff and a $1 million budget. I don't think that's what they were expecting to see. But it prepared me. In many ways, it empowered me. For real life. Because I had more good experiences than bad, and I can't complain. And then shortly after September 11th, I ran into that same guy at UCLA. I was back on campus to speak at an event, a panel that connected the Japanese American experience with the Muslim American experience, and I was talking about all those connections between the Japanese American internment camps and the U.S. Patriot Act and all these infringements to our civil liberties and how this whole never again thing is kind of a joke, because frankly, it keeps happening over and over and over again. And that guy, who had sort of called me out years ago, he was randomly on campus doing something with his transcripts. He walked up to me and he said, "I'm so glad that I ran into you, because it's really been bothering me that I treated you badly all those years ago. It's one of my real regrets in life, and I wanted to apologize. I don't know why we ran into each other today, but I'm grateful that I had this opportunity." But inside, it humbled me. It made me want to go out and apologize to other people, because it had been one of those things that hurt so much when it happened. And at the time when it happened, I thought that the people that knew me really knew me, and that they would never stoop to that level. And so when that happened, I thought, what am I doing with my life? Am I really making progress? Is this all for nothing? But I guess God has his ways. It's funny how things came full circle and sort of took care of themselves. Because that guy, he had obviously been so affected by his own actions.
Thank you.
We're going to have a very brief 1 minute interlude before we begin our next set of personal testimonies. Okay. I wanted to thank Denise for that wonderful performance. The Japanese American community had really mobilized after 9/11, and a number of organizations, including the Nikkei's Coalition for Civil Rights and Redress, held many activities to show solidarity with Arab and Muslim Americans. We also know that, unfortunately, the kind of racial intolerance that we've been hearing about has really permeated all different institutions, workplaces, schools, community groups, government. But it's particularly virulent in an environment that's fueled by the hatred and ignorance that gets perpetuated in many other ways. The next set of experiences will tell us that no one is safe in all these different realms, whether it be at work or studying or worshiping. And we'll hear about what happens when we have that kind of level of unchecked racism. We'll begin with Mr. Mujibur Rahman Badal.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. On November 7, 2001, in the evening, I was working with my own store. It's a little grocery store in Los Angeles City. And about 7:45 p.m., one by one, two guys came to the cash register. And the first guy was asking for changes. And the second guy was asking for a single cigarette purchase. And I told the second guy that I'm not permitted to sell single cigarette. But first guy, I was ready to give him change for a dollar. When I opened the cash register, I found myself in a state of, what could I say, nowhere. And the guy put his silver color revolver on my stomach and uttering that, "You bloody Arab Muslim, come this country and earning lot of money, and that's why we are starving. You have to give us all of your money right now, otherwise I'm going to kill you." I told him that it's all yours. Whatever you want to take, please take it, but don't kill me. It was witnessed by my friend. He was working on the other corner of the store with video tapes. All of a sudden, the second guy came around me, by the side of me, and then he was grabbing the money, whatever he could collect, and it took only a minute and a half, I believe, they rushed back, and when they were leaving, they were telling that next time they're going to come, so that I make them large amount of money in ready. After the incident happened, I was very afraid and I called the police. The police came, two polices came. It was videotaped in the back of my store. I stated them my statement, but I was very nervous and very scared at that time. Whatever I have to tell, I don't know, because I was not in a normal position mentally. The police collected the videotape and gave me a report. I did not read the report, but when they left, I read the report, and it was very shameful that they did not cite all the information I told them. They did not name it as a hate crime. They just wrote a regular robbery report. And I take it to the notice of South Asian Network. I talked to Brother Hamid about this, and they are helping me a lot. They arranged a second meeting with a special officer, police officer, but she failed also to term it as victim crime. When afterwards I was going to work to my store, I felt myself very isolated, afraid, and fear for life. And I was mentally depressed when, especially I'm inside the store, I see dark all over, and I see, and I feel the incident, I imagine the incident, and then I think that life is more important than my store. And then I have to sell the store for a little amount of money, and the income I drew from the store, I made the expenses of my family, as well as I was running a weekly newspaper for my community, Bangladeshi community in USA. And unfortunately, this newspaper is postponed also. I'm suffering a lot for want of fund. But lastly, I have to tell that police should be aware what they are listening and what they are writing. They are coming and going and doing their routine-wise job only, but they are not feeling what is happening. Unless they have the great feeling into their mind, this limited routine-wise work will not solve the problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Badal. It's so frustrating to hear that, because we have really tried as the commission and many other partners to make sure that police departments are educated about hate crime, that they understand what their job is here. And in fact, we received funding from the Board of Supervisors to support the organization that assisted Mr. Badal, the South Asian Network, as well as the Muslim Public Affairs Council and several other organizations. But it is a constant struggle. And we have, you know, the kind of turnover in police departments and the kind of also the training and street education that they receive, which often, unfortunately, makes them not as sensitive to these issues as they ought to be. At this time, I want to turn to our next witness, Adrian Sanchez, and just a little bit about his situation. When he was a teenager in the early 1990s, he was found guilty of a minor drug offense, and he served his time and had no legal problems after that. But as a result of the 1996 Immigration Act, he's been struggling with his ability to remain or enter this country. And we're going to hear from him now. So, Adrian?
Hi. A little bit about myself. I'll tell you a little bit about myself and my story, and then I'll tell you what the government thinks of me and how they've classified me. I came here when I was 4 years old. I've been in this country 30 years. Came here on Halloween night. I lived, went to school, been working for civil service for 15 years, got married here, had children here. For all that I know, I'm an American. But technically I'm considered an immigrant because I never became a citizen. My parents, both my sisters, they became citizens. My brother was born here. He's a citizen. I never did. I never thought it necessary. So I never did it. In 1998, I went on a family trip to Mexico with my family, with my daughter. Went to go visit my grandparents and a couple of relatives that we still have over there. And on the way back, I thought I had forgot my green card. And they stopped us at the border. Everybody showed their green card and their paperwork and everything. And I couldn't find mine, so they ran me through the computer. All this stuff popped up, and they held us there for like 5 hours in Texas. And they weren't going to let me into the country. They did. They weren't going to let me, and they paroled me into the country. But the guy said he wasn't supposed to let me in. So they did, and they said, we'll let you in, but you have to report for an interview. That's how they put it, an interview when you get back to Los Angeles. So I did, and I thought, well, I'm just going to show my green card, and everything's going to be all right. So I show up, and they put me in handcuffs. They said, we are going to deport you for the drug sales that you had in 1991. So for the $20 worth of weed that I sold when I was younger, they were going to deport me. And I kind of laughed at first, and then they put the handcuffs on and realized they were serious. And then I figured, oh, I'll bond out, you know. At that time, they weren't letting anybody bond out. If you were considered an aggravated felony, which is an aggravated felon, which is what how they determine who they're going to detain and deport. They detained you. They didn't let anybody go. Once you got under their watchful eye, they detained you, and you were deportable, period. In regular courts, the judge takes a look at your history, takes a look at if you're employed, if you have children, and you know, if you're a career criminal or if this is your only offense, and then he makes a decision. Immigration court, they don't do that. Immigration court, if you're an aggravated felon, they deport you. No questions asked. And for 5 months, they held me for 5 months. I had never been to prison. I saw prison in movies, but I had never been to prison. Basically, what I did was I went to work and I came home and I provided for my kids. So for 5 months, they held me, and I was a number to them because every time I went to court, I didn't get to speak. They didn't ask me anything about myself. The only thing that the judge has had before him was paper that said I was an aggravated felon and I was supposed to be deported. So every time I went to court, we would ask for a bail, bond, and it was denied. So I had to quit my job. And for 5 months in Terminal Island, my parents came to see me every weekend. My daughter came, and I got to see them behind a nice plexiglass window. And it was a very hard time for me. I was very depressed. If I was to tell you about the conditions in this place, you wouldn't believe it, because you'd think that kind of stuff happens in other countries, and we, the United States, is the police of the entire world. And we go and we are a model for these other countries, for them to see how they're supposed to live and how their governments are supposed to act and treat people. And they don't have it right in their own backyard. And so the human rights that our people are dying for aren't granted to our own citizens of this country. That's the irony of this whole thing. So finally, after 5 months, they let me out. And for 2 years after that, I think there was more agony in my everyday life, being scared out of my head that I could be deported and be taken away from my children. Anybody that has children would know that fear that you face, that your child would ever be taken away from you or that you would be taken away from them. And so I lived in fear for 2 years because I kept going to court and they kept giving me other court dates. And at that time, everybody was being deported. Everybody. And so I've gone half a dozen times to D.C. and I've been to countless meetings with our representatives and told them about this law, the 1996 Anti-Terrorist Immigration Reform Act, which is what they're trying to deport us under. And they don't seem to really care. They think that it's something happening in a far-off place, that it's not in their own country. It's not just me. There's thousands and thousands of people that are going through the same thing, and even worse, when I hear some of the stories that I heard today, my experience seems minimal. But it's a big... The government has to justify its war on terrorism, its war on immigrants, and they have to cite these extreme examples, and they have to pass all these laws, and they have to pass war on drugs and war on terrorism and all that stuff. And the laws that they're passing are affecting everyday, responsible, working individuals like myself, like everybody in this room. What's even scarier is that people are standing by and letting this happen. We need to speak up. Thank you.
Now we have Tomas Solis. Tomas, are you here? Okay. Just a little bit about what Tomas will talk about. There's something called a Social Security no match policy. If you're an employee and your Social Security number doesn't match the one that they have on record, they send letters to your employer with no chance to respond. And this is what happened to Tomas when that occurred.
Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Tomás Solís Lara. Trabajé por un poco más de 3 años en el supermercado. El supermercado coreano así hasta el día de mi suspensión el primero de agosto del 2002. Después de diversos intentos por destruir nuestro movimiento, se refugió en la carta de no coincide para suspender a más de 60 trabajadores de nuestra suspensión. No fue algo casual. Fue una combinación de diversos elementos de los cuales quiero hablarles.
Good morning. My name is Tomás Solís Lara. I work at Asian Market, a wealthy supermarket that is in Koreatown. For more than 3 years, and I worked there for more than 3 years, ASI, after many attempts for destroying our union efforts, found an excuse to suspend over 60 workers, the no match letter. Our suspension was not a single casualty, it was a combination of many events that I want to talk about.
Cuando inicié mis labores en el ASI, Mis necesidades me hizo concentrarme solo en mi trabajo. Después de cierto tiempo, las condiciones de trabajo me hicieron reaccionar, al igual que a la mayoría de mis compañeros, los trabajadores. Para en ese entonces, mi esposa Betty era parte de la fuerza laboral de ASI. Nuestras labores de trabajo no solo contenían y requerían un gran esfuerzo físico, pero también incluían abusos, insultos, maltratos verbales y algunas veces hasta maltratos físicos. Todas estas condiciones despertaron en nosotros los trabajadores la necesidad de cambiar nuestras condiciones de trabajo.
When I just started working at ASI, I was in so much need that I just wanted to put attention in my work. After a while, my worker conditions made me react as well as my fellow co-workers. But that time, Betty, my wife, was part of ASI labor force. Our duties were not only required lots of physical efforts, but they included harassment, discrimination, verbal and physical abuse. These conditions awoke in all of us workers the need to change our worker conditions.
La suspensión de nuestros compañeros de ASI, la mía y la de mi esposa, no fue solo un intento en contra de nuestros derechos. Fue un atentado a nuestra vida, así como un atentado al bienestar de mi familia, y mi vida se transformó desde el momento en nuestra... Se transformó en una situación muy desesperada, principalmente para mí, porque actualmente yo estoy enfermo. Gracias a tanto trabajo que tuvimos, tantas presiones en la compañía en la que estábamos trabajando, pero actualmente yo necesito un trasplante de riñón, porque trabajé mucho en esa compañía y desgraciadamente me enfermé. Empezamos a organizarnos.
The suspension of our co-workers, my wife and mine, was not only an attack to our rights, it was an attack to our lives as well as an attack to the well-being of our families. My life was changed since that moment. My wife, my children, and myself have had really difficult times, especially because my health is in very bad conditions. I had a kidney disease, and I'm currently on dialysis. The only way to recover my health is through a kidney transplant, but I can't afford the surgery because I was suspended.
Empezamos a organizarnos secretamente en junio del 2001. Para noviembre del mismo año iniciamos el proceso para el reconocimiento de nuestro sindicato ante la Junta Nacional de Relaciones Laborales, el NLRB, y decidimos anunciar públicamente nuestra campaña de sindicalización. El fruto de este esfuerzo dio vida al Sindicato de Trabajadores Inmigrantes Kigwa. Después de una intensa lucha con la prensa, logramos determinar una fecha para nuestra elección el 9 de marzo del 2002.
So we started organizing secretly ourselves in June 2001. By November of that year, we decided to open a public campaign after doing many collective actions in our workplace. And then we filed a recognition petition with the NLRB. And that's how the Immigrant Workers Union was born. After a strong fight with the market, we were able to agree to an election day. The election was held on March 2002.
Desafortunadamente, debido a las prácticas sucias de la empresa, tomó en contra del sindicato. El resultado de las elecciones determinó en un empate. Sin embargo, nuestros esfuerzos de no terminaron ahí. Nosotros continuamos organizándonos La empresa, al no encontrar una mejor excusa, utilizó la carta de no coincide para suspender a más de 60 trabajadores. La mayoría de ellos apoyaban al movimiento de sindicalización. Nosotros pensamos en nuestra suspensión no fue justa. El supermercado tomó ventaja de este documento, aun cuando la misma carta contenía el mensaje de no ser utilizada para suspender, despedir, discriminar o castigar a los trabajadores.
Unfortunately, the election ended in a tie because the market not only hired a union buster law firm, but also used many dirty tactics against us. Despite all the efforts that the market made in order to destroy our movement, we stay organized. ASI, not finding a way to destroy our struggle, found the no match letter as a good excuse to suspend more than 60 workers, most of them pro-union workers. We believe that our suspension was not fair. The market took advantage of the letter and the political climate. Even though the letter stated that it could not be used to suspend, discriminate against, retaliate, or fire any worker.
Muchísimas gracias por habernos escuchado y estoy consciente que todo en la vida tiene que lucharse y unidos saldremos adelante. Gracias.
Thank you for hearing our statement, and I hope and I know that all of us united we can continue the struggle. Thank you.
With that, we conclude the testimony of our witnesses, and I wanted to thank all of those who have testified. In fact, I'd like all of us to stand up and give them a standing ovation for what they've done today, for us today. I apologize. We actually do have one more testimony from Najiba Saeed Miller. I'm sorry I didn't see in the audience here. Najiba is someone I actually have known for a while and have been always very impressed with, and I asked her to come to share with us some of the things that I heard about on September 13th of 2001 when we had that community meeting, and Najiba was there and shared some of what she was experiencing and had heard from others. So I appreciate her being here today. Let's hear from her.
Thank you. I'm going to just read some of the statements that I made at the press conference that the Human Relations Commission held earlier this year. I wanted to share with you two incidents about 3 weeks ago, just to show you that harassment continues. I walked down Wilshire Boulevard to my office in downtown LA, and about 2 weeks ago, someone spit in my face. And then about 2 months ago, recently, someone used the word F you and your people. So my assumption is both of those actions were related to some view of myself. Basically, since 9/11, it has been a deeply personal feeling, a silent wound that I'm afraid to wear in my sleeve. I've spent much time trying to blend in and have people look beyond what is on the outside, and we have been doing this and doing it for years. I want to share with you that hate did not begin with 9/11. It is there under the surface, waiting to rear its head. It has happened before. I remember during the Iran hostage affair, scarves were pulled off our heads. Go home was a refrain on the radio, the streets, and the pain of loss was shooting out to me in the symbolism that I did not even know I possessed for people. I am subjected to the change of tides of what happens abroad. Every political shift becomes manifested in some slight change of behavior with me or against me. I am a walking symbol, a walking target, that I'm not even aware of the extent to which I represent oppression, backwardness, or any other list of things which you may pin on me. Since 9/11, for a few months, I changed my appearance, tied my scarf up, and hid it behind a straw hat. I could not even look in the mirror but for the shame I felt thrust upon me. I went everywhere, taking my husband with me to protect me. His white skin was a shield. Walking around and suddenly walking into the store, and conversation turns from people around me to comments like, let's slit the throats of all those terrorists, to things like when I'm doing a diversity training in bias reduction targeted towards me, why don't we just nuke them all and let God decide? What do you say to such things? How far can your understanding go? My younger brother was told that he should go to a concentration camp after 9/11. These are some of the stories I want to share, and because we're out of time, I will just leave you with a comment that I thought was very powerful by Ayako Nagihara, NCR co-chair, when she said, "We have many lessons to draw from the camps. We learn that we must safeguard our civil liberties, especially in times of perceived threats, and support those who face discrimination or threats based on race or ethnicity." Those are the lessons learned by Japanese Americans from the camps in World War II. I also wanted to share with you that we're working on story gathering of Muslim, Mexican, and Japanese Americans around relocation, repatriation, and deportation. If you're interested in the story gathering workshops, there's information in the back. Thank you for this forum and for keeping your hearts open.
Najiba. Now we are going to transition to the key witnesses that we've asked to come here today, or continue those key witnesses. You heard from Martin Ludlow. We wanted to bring to you people here who really have standing in our community and in many ways represent great hopes for us in terms of turning these stories into changes in our institutions in our lives. And I want to first introduce to you the next key witness we have, which is Maria Elena Durazo, someone who I'm sure many of you have heard of. She is someone I've had the pleasure to know for a long time, and I've always just been so impressed. She is president of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, Local 11. And she is the first woman to be elected to a national position in a union. She has really steered Local 11 to become a vital force since she was elected in 1989, really improving the lives of working people here in Los Angeles. And the union represents 250,000 members. She's a daughter of Mexican immigrants who she worked in the fields of California until she was in high school. And she started as an organizer with the ILGWU and then with Local 11. And 70% of the Local 11 membership are immigrants from Mexico and Central America. We're very fortunate to have her with us today. Marilena.